His jaw was a prayer, I thought. But when I glanced at him, his jaw was clenched, face set in lines of fear. I was aware that I had spoken aloud until the barber, shading his eyes next to me, replied, "There's a trap door built in the roof of the print shop, ma'am. Need doubt Mr. Malcolm means to gain access to the upper story, so. Is it his prentice up there, do you know?" "No," Ian snapped, hearing this. "It's my son." The barber shrank back before Ian's glare, murmuring, "Oh, aye, just so, sir, just so," and crossing himself. A shout from the crowd grew into a roar as two figures appeared on the roof of the chocolate shop, and Ian dropped my hand, springing forward. Jamie had his arm round young Ian, who was bent and reeling from the smoke he had swallowed. It was reasonably obvious that neither of them was going to be able to negotiate a return through the adjoining building in his present condition. Just then, Jamie spotted Ian below. Cupping his hand around his mouth, he bellowed, "Rope!" Rope there was. The town guard had come equipped. Ian snatched the coil from an approaching guardsman, leaving that worthy blinking in indignation, and turned to face the house. I caught the gleam of Jamie's teeth as he grinned down at his brother-in-law, and the look of answering wryness on Ian's face. How many times had they thrown a rope between them to raise hay to the barn loft, or bind a load to the wagon for carrying? The crowd fell back from the whirl of Ian's arm, and the heavy coil flew up in a smooth parabola, unwinding as it went, landing on Jamie's outstretched arm with the precision of a bumblebee lighting on a flower. Jamie hauled in the dangling tail and disappeared momentarily to anchor the rope about the base of the building's chimney. A few precarious moments' work, and the two smoke-blackened figures had come to a safe landing on the pavement below. Young Ian, rope slung under his arms and round his chest, stood upright for a moment. Then, as the tension of the rope slackened, his knees buckled, and he slid into a gangling heap on the cobbles.
This ends Disc 14. Voyager, Disc 15.
"Are ye all right? Avalach, speak to me." Ian fell to his knees beside his son, anxiously trying to unknot the rope round young Ian's chest, while simultaneously trying to lift up the lad's lolling head. Jamie was leaning against the railing of the chocolate shop, black in the face and coughing his lungs out, but otherwise apparently unharmed. I sat down on the boy's other side and took his head on my lap. I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry at the sight of him. When I had seen him in the morning, he had been an appealing-looking lad, if no great beauty, with something of his father's homely, good-natured looks. Now, at evening, the thick hair over one side of his forehead had been singed to a bleached red stubble, and his eyebrows and lashes had been burned off entirely. The skin beneath was the soot-smeared bright pink of a suckling pig just off the spit. I felt for a pulse in the spindly neck and found it reassuringly strong. His breathing was hoarse and irregular, and no wonder. I hoped the lining of his lungs hadn't been burned. He coughed long and rackingly, and the thin body convulsed on my lap. "Is he all right?" Ian's hands instinctively grabbed his son beneath the armpits and sat him up. His head wobbled to and fro, and he pitched forward into my arms. "I think so. I can't tell for sure." The boy was still coughing, but not fully conscious. I held him against my shoulder like an enormous baby, patting his back futilely as he retched and gagged. "Is he all right?" This time it was Jamie squatting breathless alongside me. His voice was so hoarse I wouldn't have recognized it, roughened as it was by smoke. "I think so. What about you? You look like Malcolm X," I said, peering at him over young Ian's heaving shoulder.
"I do."
He put a hand to his face, looking startled, then grinned reassuringly.
"Nay, I canna see how I look, but I'm no an ex-Malcolm yet.
only a wee bit singed round the edges. Get back, get back! The guard captain was at my side, grey beard bristling with anxiety, plucking at my sleeve. Move yourself, ma'am, the roof's going. Sure enough, as we scrambled to safety, the roof of the print shop fell in, and an awed sound rose from the watching crowd as an enormous fountain of sparks whirled skyward, brilliant against the darkening sky. As though heaven resented this intrusion, the spume of fiery ash was answered by the first pattering of raindrops plopping heavily on the cobbles all around us. The Edinburgh people, who surely ought to have been accustomed to rain by now, made noises of consternation and began to scuttle back into the surrounding buildings like a herd of cockroaches, leaving nature to complete the fire engine's work. A moment later, Ian and I were alone with young Ian, Jamie having dispensed money liberally to the guard and other assistants, and having arranged for his press and its fittings to be housed in the barber's storeroom, trudged wearily toward us. "How's the lad?" he asked, wiping a hand down his face. The rain had begun to come down more heavily, and the effect on his soot-blackened countenance was picturesque in the extreme. Ian looked at him, and for the first time the anger, worry, and fear faded somewhat from his countenance. He gave Jamie a lopsided smile.
"He does na look a great deal better than you do yourself, man, but I think he'll do now. Give us a hand, eh?"
Murmuring small Gaelic endearments suitable for babies, Ian bent over his son, who was by this time sitting up groggily on the curbstone, swaying to and fro like a heron in a high wind. By the time we reached Madame Jeanne's establishment, young Ian could walk, though still supported on either side by his father and uncle. Bruno, who opened the door, blinked incredulously at the sight, and then swung the door open, laughing so hard he could barely close it after us. I had to admit that we were nothing much to look at, wet through and streaming with rain. Jamie and I were both barefoot, and Jamie's clothes were in rags, singed and torn and covered with streaks of soot. Ian's dark hair straggled in his eyes, making him look like a drowned rat with a wooden leg. Young Ian, though, was the focus of attention, as multiple heads came popping out of the drawing-room in response to the noise Bruno was making. With his singed hair, swollen red face, beaky nose, and lashless, blinking eyes, he strongly resembled the fledgling young of some exotic bird species. A newly hatched flamingo, perhaps. His face could scarcely grow redder, but the back of his neck flamed crimson as the sound of feminine giggles followed us up the stairs. Safely ensconced in the small upstairs sitting room with the door closed, Ian turned to face his hapless offspring.
"Going to live, are ye, ye wee bugger?" he demanded.
"Aye, sir,"
young Ian replied in a dismal croak, looking rather as though he wished the answer were no.
"Good," his father said grimly. "Do you want to explain yourself, or shall I just belt hell out of you now and save us both time?"
"Gonna thrash someone who's just had his eyebrows burnt off, Ian,"
Jamie protested hoarsely, pouring out a glass of porter from the decanter on the table.
"It wouldn't be humane."
He grinned at his nephew and handed him the glass, which the boy clutched with alacrity.
"Aye, well, perhaps not," Ian agreed, surveying his son.
One corner of his mouth twitched. Young Ian was a pitiable sight. He was also an extremely funny one.
"That doesn't mean you aren't going to get your ass blistered later, mind," he warned the boy. "And that's besides whatever your mother means to do to you when she sees you again. But for now, lad, take your ease."
Not noticeably reassured by the magnanimous tone of this last statement, young Ian didn't answer, but sought refuge in the depths of his glass of porter.
I took my own glass with a good deal of pleasure. I had realised belatedly just why the citizens of Edinburgh reacted to rain with such repugnance. Once one was wet through, it was the devil to get dry again in the damp confines of a stone house with no change of clothes and no heat available but a small hearth fire.
I plucked the damp bodice away from my breasts, caught young Ian's interested glance, and decided regretfully that I really couldn't take it off with the boy in the room. Jamie seemed to have been corrupting the lad to quite a sufficient extent already. I gulped the porter instead, feeling the rich flavour purl warmingly through my innards.
"You feel well enough to talk a bit, lad?"
Jamie sat down opposite his nephew, next to Ian on the hassock.
I think so, young Ian croaked cautiously.
He cleared his throat like a bullfrog and repeated more firmly,
I can. Good. Well then, first, how did you come to be in the print shop? And then, how did it come to be on fire?
Young Ian pondered that one for a moment, then took another gulp of his porter for courage and said,
I set it.
Jamie and Ian both sat up straight at that. I could see Jamie revising his opinion as to the advisability of thrashing people without eyebrows, but he mastered his temper with an obvious effort and said merely,
Why?
The boy took another gulp of porter, coughed, and drank again, apparently trying to decide what to say.
Well, he began uncertainly, there was a man,
and came to a dead stop.
A man?
Jamie prompted patiently when his nephew showed signs of having become suddenly deaf and dumb.
What man?
Young Ian clutched his glass in both hands, looking deeply unhappy.
Answer your uncle this minute, Clot, Ian said sharply, or I'll take you across my knee and tan you right here.
With a mixture of similar threats and promptings, the two men managed to extract a more or less coherent story from the boy. Young Ian had been at the tavern at Kerse that morning, where he had been told to meet Wally, who would come down from the rendezvous with the wagons of brandy, there to load the punked casks and spoiled wine to be used as subterfuge.
"Told?" Ian asked sharply. "Who told ye?"
"I did,"
Jamie said, before young Ian could speak. He waved a hand at his brother-in-law, urging silence.
"Aye, I kent he was here. We'll talk about it later, Ian, if you please. It's important we know what happened today."
Ian glared at Jamie and opened his mouth to disagree, then shut it with a snap. He nodded to his son to go on.
"I was hungry, you see," young Ian said.
"When are you not?"
his father and uncle said together in perfect unison. They looked at each other, snorted with sudden laughter, and the strained atmosphere in the room eased slightly.
"So you went into the tavern to have a bite," Jamie said. "That's all right, lad, no harm done. And what happened while you were there?"
That, it transpired, was where he had seen the man. A small, ratty-looking fellow with a seaman's pigtail and a blind eye talking to the landlord.
"He was asking for you, Uncle Jamie," young Ian said,
growing easier in his speech with repeated applications of porter.
"By your own name?"
Jamie started, looking surprised.
"Jamie Fraser, you mean?"
Young Ian nodded, sipping.
"Aye, but he knew your other name as well. Jamie Roy, I mean."
"Jamie Roy?"
Ian turned a puzzled glance on his brother-in-law, who shrugged impatiently.
"It's how I'm known on the docks. Christ, Ian, you know what I do." "Aye, I do. But I didn't ken the wee laddie was helping ye to do it."
Ian's thin lips pressed tight together, and he turned his attention back to his son.
"Go on, lad. I will not interrupt you again."
The seaman had asked the tavern keeper how best an old sea dog, down on his luck and looking for employment, might find one Jamie Fraser, who was known to have a use for able men. The landlord, pleading ignorance of that name, the seaman had leaned closer, pushed a coin across the table, and, in a lowered voice, asked whether the name Jamie Roy was more familiar. The landlord, remaining deaf as an adder, the seaman had soon left the tavern with young Ian right behind him.
"I thought as how maybe it would be good to know who he was and what he meant," the lad explained, blinking.
"You might have thought to leave word with the publican for Wally," Jamie said. "Still, that's neither here nor there. Where did he go?"
down the road at a brisk walk, but not so brisk that a healthy boy couldn't follow at a careful distance. An accomplished walker, the seaman had made his way into Edinburgh, a distance of some 5 miles in less than an hour, and arrived at last at the Green Owl Tavern, followed by young Ian, near wilted with thirst from the walk. I started at the name, but didn't say anything, not wanting to interrupt the story. "It was terrible crowded," the lad reported. "Something happened in the morning, and everyone was talking of it, but they shut up whenever they saw me. Anyway, it was the same there." He paused to cough and clear his throat. "The seaman ordered drink, brandy, then asked the landlord was he acquainted with a supplier of brandy named Jamie Roy or Jamie Fraser."
"Did he, then?" Jamie murmured.
His gaze was intent on his nephew, but I could see the thoughts working behind his high forehead, making a small crease between his thick brows. The man had gone methodically from tavern to tavern, dogged by his faithful shadow, and in each establishment had ordered brandy and repeated his question.
"He must have a rare head to be drinking that much brandy," Ian remarked.
Young Ian shook his head. "He didn't drink it. He only smelt it." His father clicked his tongue at such a scandalous waste of good spirit, but Jamie's red brows climbed still higher.
"Did he taste any of it?" he asked sharply.
"Aye. At the Dog and Gun, and again at the Blue Boar. He had nae more than a wee taste, though, and then left the glass untouched. He didn't drink at all at the other places, and we went to 5 of them before—"
He trailed off and took another drink. Jamie's face underwent an astonishing transformation. From an expression of frowning puzzlement, his face went completely blank, then resolved itself into an expression of revelation.
"Is that so now?" he said softly to himself. "Indeed."
His attention came back to his nephew.
"And then what happened, lad?"
Young Ian was beginning to look unhappy again. He gulped, the tremor visible all the way down his skinny neck.
"Well, it was a terrible long way from Kers to Edinburgh," he began, "and a terrible dry walk, too."
His father and uncle exchanged jaundiced glances.
"You drank too much," Jamie said, resigned.
"Well, I didn't ken he was going to so many taverns now, did I?"
young Ian cried in self-defence, growing pink in the ears.
"No, of course not, lad,"
Jamie said kindly, smothering the beginning of Ian's more censorious remarks.
"How long did you last?"
Until midway down the Royal Mile, it turned out, where young Ian, overcome by the accumulation of early risings, a 5-mile walk, and the effects of something like 2 quarts of ale, had dozed off in a corner, waking an hour later to find his quarry long gone.
"So I came here," he explained. "I thought as how Uncle Jimmy should know about it. But he wasn't here."
The boy glanced at me, and his ears grew still pinker.
"And just why do you think he should be here?"
Ian favoured his offspring with a gimlet eye, which then swivelled to his brother-in-law. The simmering anger Ian had been holding in check since the morning suddenly erupted.
"The filthy gall of ye, Jamie Fraser, taking my son to a bawdy house!" "A fine one you are to talk, da!"
Young Ian was on his feet, swaying a bit, but with his big bony hands clenched at his sides.
"Me? And what do you mean by that, you wee gomeral?"
Ian cried, his eyes going wide with outrage.
"I mean, you're a damned hypocrite!" his son shouted hoarsely. "Preaching to me and Michael about purity and keeping to one woman, and all the time you're slinking about the city sniffing after whores."
"What?"
Ian's face had gone entirely purple. I looked in some alarm to Jamie, who appeared to be finding something funny in the present situation.
"You're a goddamned whited sepulchre,"
young Ian came up with the simile triumphantly, then paused as though trying to think of another to equal it. His mouth opened, though nothing emerged but a soft belch.
"That boy is rather drunk," I said to Jamie.
He picked up the decanter of porter, eyed the level within, and set it down.
"You're right," he said. "I should have noticed sooner, but it's hard to tell, scorched as he is."
The elder Ian wasn't drunk, but his expression strongly resembled his offspring's, what with the suffused countenance, popping eyes, and straining neck cords.
"What the bloody stinking hell do you mean by that, you whelp?" he shouted.
He moved menacingly toward young Ian, who took an involuntary step backward and sat down quite suddenly as his calves met the edge of the sofa.
"Her,"
he said, startled into monosyllables. He pointed at me to make it clear.
"Her, you deceiving my man with this filthy whore, that's what I mean."
Ian fetched his son a clout over the ear that knocked him sprawling on the sofa.
"Ye great clot," he said, scandalised. "A fine way to speak of your Auntie Claire, to say nothing of me and your mum."
"Aunt?"
Young Ian gawped at me from the cushions, looking so like a nestling begging for food that I burst out laughing despite myself.
"You left before I could introduce myself this morning," I said. "But you're dead,"
he said stupidly.
"Not yet,"
I assured him, "unless I've caught pneumonia from sitting here in a damp dress." His eyes had grown perfectly round as he stared at me. Now a fugitive gleam of excitement came into them.
"Some of the old women at Lallybroch say you were a wise woman, a white lady or even a fairy. When Uncle Jimmy came home from Culloden without you, they said as how you'd maybe gone back to the fairies, where you maybe came from. Is that true? Do you live in a dun?"
I exchanged a glance with Jamie, who rolled his eyes toward the ceiling.
"No," I said. I...
"She escaped to France after Culloden," Ian broke in suddenly with great firmness. "She thought your Uncle Jamie was killed in the battle, so she went to her kin in France. She'd been one of Prince Charlach's particular friends. She couldn't come back to Scotland after the war without putting herself in sore danger. But then she heard of your uncle, and as soon as she kent that her husband was indeed after all, she took ship at once and came to find him."
Young Ian's mouth hung open slightly. So did mine.
Yes, I said, closing it. "That's what happened."
The lad turned large, shining eyes from me to his uncle.
"So you've come back to him," he said happily. "God, that's romantic."
The tension of the moment was broken. Ian hesitated, but his eyes softened as he looked from Jamie to me.
"Aye," he said, and smiled reluctantly. "Aye, I suppose it is."
"I didn't expect to be doing this for him for a good 2 or 3 years yet," Jamie remarked, holding his nephew's head with an expert hand as young Ian retched painfully into the spittoon I was holding.
"Aye, well, he's always been forward," Ian answered resignedly. "Learned to walk before he could stand, and was forever tumbling into the fire or the washpot or the pig pen or the cow byre."
He patted the skinny, heaving back.
"There, lad, let it come."
A little more, and the lad was deposited in a wilted heap on the sofa, there to recover from the effects of smoke, emotion, and too much porter under the censoriously mingled gaze of uncle and father.
"Where's that damn tea I sent for?"
Jamie reached impatiently for the bell, but I stopped him. The brothel's domestic arrangements were evidently still disarranged from the excitements of the morning.
"Don't bother," I said.
"I'll go down and fetch it." I scooped up the spittoon and carried it with me at arm's length, hearing Ian say behind me in a reasonable tone of voice, "Look, fool!" I found my way to the kitchen with no difficulty and obtained the necessary supplies. I hoped Jamie and Ian would give the boy a few minutes' respite, not only for his own sake, but so that I would miss nothing of his story. I had clearly missed something when I returned to the small sitting room. An air of constraint hung over the room like a cloud, and young Ian glanced up and then quickly away to avoid my eye. Jamie was his usual, imperturbable self, but the elder Ian looked almost as flushed and uneasy as his son. He hurried forward to take the tray from me, murmuring thanks, but wouldn't meet my eye. I raised one eyebrow at Jamie, who gave me a slight smile and a shrug. I shrugged back and picked up one of the bowls on the tray.
"Bread and milk," I said, handing it to young Ian, who at once looked happier.
"Hot tea?" I said, handing the pot to his father.
"Whiskey," I said, handing the bottle to Jamie. "And cold tea for the Burns."
I whisked the lid off the last bowl, in which a number of napkins were soaking in cold tea.
"Cold tea?"
Jamie's ruddy brows lifted.
"Did the cook have no butter?"
"You don't put butter on Burns," I told him. "Aloe juice, or the juice of a plantain or plantago. But the cook didn't have any of that.
Cold tea is the best we could manage." I poulticed young Ian's blistered hands and forearms and blotted his scarlet face gently with the tea-soaked napkins while Jamie and Ian did the honours with teapot and whiskey bottle, after which we all sat down, somewhat restored, to hear the rest of Ian's story.
"Well," he began, "I walked about the city for a bit, trying to think what best to do. And finally my head cleared a bit, and I reasoned that if the man I'd been following was going from tavern to tavern down the high street, if I went to the other end and started up the street, I could maybe find him that way."
"That was a bright thought," Jamie said,
and Ian nodded approvingly, the frown lifting a bit from his face.
"Did you find him?"
Young Ian nodded, slurping a bit.
"I did then."
Running down the Royal Mile, nearly to the Palace of Holyrood at the foot, he had toiled his way painstakingly up the street, stopping at each tavern to inquire for the man with the pigtail and one eye. There was no word of his quarry anywhere below the Canongate, and he was beginning to despair of his idea when suddenly he had seen the man himself sitting in the tap room of the Holyrood Brewery. Presumably this stop was for respite rather than information, for the seaman was sitting at his ease drinking beer. Young Ian had darted behind a hogshead in the yard and remained there, watching, until at length the man rose, paid his score, and made his leisurely way outside.
"He didn't go to any more taverns," the boy reported,
wiping a stray drop of milk off his chin.
"He went straight to Carfax Close, to the print shop."
Jamie said something in Gaelic under his breath. "Did he? And what then?"
"Well, he found the shop shut up, of course. When he saw the door was locked, he looked careful-like up at the windows, as though he was maybe thinking of breaking in. But then I saw him look about, at all the folk coming and going. It was a busy time of day, we all the folk coming to the chocolate shop. So he stood on the stoop a moment, thinking, and then he set off back up the close. I had to duck into the tailor shop on the corner so as not to be seen."
The man had paused at the entrance of the close, then, making up his mind, had turned to the right, gone down a few paces, and disappeared into a small alley.
"I kent as how the alley led up to the court at the back of the close," young Ian explained, "so I saw at once what he meant to be doing."
"There's a wee court at the back of the close,"
Jamie explained, seeing my puzzled look.
"That's for rubbish and deliveries and such. But there's a back door out of the print shop opens onto it."
Young Ian nodded, putting down his empty bowl.
"Aye, I thought it must be that he meant to get into the place. And I thought of the new pamphlets."
"Jesus," Jamie said.
He looked a little pale.
"Pamphlets?"
Ian raised his brows at Jamie.
"What kind of pamphlets?"
"The new printing for Mr. Gage," young Ian explained.
Ian still looked as blank as I felt.
"Politics,"
Jamie said bluntly.
"An argument for repeal of the last Stamp Act, with an exhortation to civil opposition by violence if necessary. 5,000 of them, fresh printed, stacked in the back room. Gage was to come round and get them in the morning, tomorrow."
"Jesus," Ian said.
He had gone even paler than Jamie, at whom he stared in a sort of mingled horror and awe.
"Have ye gone straight out of your mind?" he inquired. "You, we not an inch on your back unscarred, with the ink scarce dry on your pardon for treason. You're mixed up with Tom Gage and his seditious society and got my son involved as well."
His voice had been rising throughout, and now he sprang to his feet, fists clenched.
"How could you do such a thing, Jamie? How? Have we not suffered enough for your actions, Jenny and me? All through the war and after. Christ, I'd think you'd have had your fill of prisons and blood and violence."
"I have," Jamie said shortly. "I'm no part of Gage's group, but my business is printing, aye? He paid for those pamphlets."
Ian threw up his hands in a gesture of vast irritation. "Oh, aye. And that will mean a great deal when the Crown's agents arrest you and take you to London to be hanged. If those things were to be found on your premises..."
Struck by a sudden thought, he stopped and turned to his son.
"Oh, that was it," he asked. "You kent what those pamphlets were. That's why ye set them on fire."
Young Ian nodded, solemn as a young owl.
"I couldn't have moved them in time," he said. "Not 5,000. The man, the seaman, he'd broke out the back window and he was reaching in for the door latch."
Ian whirled back to face Jamie.
"Damn you," he said violently. "Damn you for a reckless, harebrained fool, Jamie Fraser. First the Jacobites and now this."
Jamie had flushed up at once at Ian's words, and his face grew darker at this.
"Am I to blame for Charles Stuart?" he said.
His eyes flashed angrily, and he set his teacup down with a thump that sloshed tea and whisky over the polished tabletop.
"Did I not try all I could to stop the wee fool? Did I not give up everything in that fight? Everything, Ian! My land, my freedom, my wife! To try to save us all!"
He glanced at me briefly as he spoke, and I caught one very small, quick glimpse of just what the last 20 years had cost him. He turned back to Ian, his brows lowering as he went on, voice growing hard.
"And as for what I've cost your family, what have you profited, Ian? Lallybroch belongs to wee James now, no? To your son, not mine."
Ian flinched at that.
"I never asked," he began.
"No, you didn't. I'm no accusing you for God's sake, but the fact's there. Lallybroch's no mine any more, is it? My father left it to me, and I cared for it as best as I could. Took care of the land and the tenants. And you helped me, Ian."
His voice softened a bit. "I couldn't have managed without you and Jenny. I didn't begrudge deeding it to young Jamie. It had to be done. But still..."
He turned away for a moment, head bowed, broad shoulders knotted tight beneath the linen of his shirt. I was afraid to move or speak, but I caught young Ian's eye filled with infinite distress. I put a hand on his skinny shoulder for mutual reassurance and felt the steady pounding of the pulse in the tender flesh above his collarbone. He set his big bony paw on my hand and held on tight. Jamie turned back to his brother-in-law, struggling to keep his voice and temper under control.
"I swear to you, Ian, I didna let the lad be put in danger. I kept him out of the way so much as I possibly could. Didna let the shoreman see him or let him go out in the boats with Fergus, hard as he begged me."
He glanced at young Ian, and his expression changed to an odd mixture of affection and irritation.
"I didna ask him to come to me, Ian, and I told him he must go home again." "You didna make him go, though, did you?"
The angry colour was fading from Ian's face, but his soft brown eyes were still narrow and bright with fury.
"And you didna send word either. For God's sake, Jamie, Jenny hasna slept at night any time this month."
Jamie's lips pressed tight.
"No,"
he said, letting the words escape one at a time.
"No, I didn't. I..."
He glanced at the boy again and shrugged uncomfortably, as though his shirt had grown suddenly too tight.
"No," he said again.
I meant to take him home myself.
He's old enough to travel by himself,
Ian said shortly. He got here alone, no?
Aye, that wasna that.
Jamie turned aside restlessly, picking up a teacup and rolling it to and fro between his palms.
No. I meant to take him so that I could ask your permission, yours and Jenny's, for the lad to come live with me for a time.
Ian uttered a short, sarcastic laugh.
Oh, aye. Give our permission for him to be hanged or transported alongside you, eh?
The anger flashed across Jamie's features again as he looked up from the cup in his hand.
You know I wouldn't have let any harm come to him, he said. For Christ's sake, Ian. I care for the lad as though he were my own son, and well you ken it too.
Ian's breath was coming fast. I could hear it from my place behind the sofa.
Oh, I ken it well enough, he said, staring hard into Jamie's face. But he's not your son, aye. He's mine.
Jamie stared back for a long moment, then reached out and gently set the teacup back on the table.
Aye, he said quietly. He is.
Ian stood for a moment, breathing hard, then wiped a hand carelessly across his forehead, pushing back the thick, dark hair.
Well, then, he said.
He took one or two deep breaths and turned to his son.
Come along, then, he said. I've a room at Halliday's.
Young Ian's bony fingers tightened on mine. His throat worked, but he didn't move to rise from his seat.
No, da, he said.
His voice quivered, and he blinked hard not to cry.
I'm no going wi' you.
Ian's face went quite pale, with a deep red patch over the angular cheekbones, as though someone had slapped him hard on both cheeks.
Is that so? He said.
Young Ian nodded, swallowing.
I'll go wi' in the morning, da. I'll go home wi' you, but not now.
Ian looked at his son for a long moment without speaking. Then his shoulders slumped and all the tension went out of his body.
I see, he said quietly. Well, then. Well.
Without another word, he turned and left, closing the door very carefully behind him. I could hear the awkward thump of his wooden leg on each step as he made his way down the stair. There was a brief sound of shuffling as he reached the bottom, then Bruno's voice in farewell, and the thud of the main door shutting. And then there was no sound in the room but the hiss of the hearth fire behind me. The boy's shoulder was shaking under my hand, and he was holding tighter than ever to my fingers, crying without making a sound. Jamie came slowly to sit beside him, his face full of troubled helplessness.
Ian. Oh, wee Ian, he said. Christ, laddie, you shouldn't have done that. I had to, Ian gasped, and gave a sudden snuffle, and I realised that he'd been holding his breath.
He turned a scorched countenance on his uncle, raw features contorted in anguish.
I did not want to hurt Da, he said. I didn't.
Jamie patted his knee absently.
Oh, no, laddie, he said. But to say such a thing to him. I could not tell him, though, and I had to tell you, Uncle Jamie.
Jamie glanced up, suddenly alert at his nephew's tone.
Tell me. Tell me what? The man. The man with the pigtail. What about him?
Young Ian licked his lips, steeling himself.
I think I killed him, he whispered.
Startled, Jamie glanced at me, then back at young Ian.
How?
He asked.
Well, I lied a bit,
Ian began, voice trembling. The tears were still welling in his eyes, but he brushed them aside.
When I went into the print shop, I had the key you gave me. The man was already inside.
The seaman had been in the backmost room of the shop where the stacks of newly printed orders were kept, along with the stocks of fresh ink, the blotting papers used to clean the press, and the small forge where worn slugs were melted down and recast into fresh type.
He was taking some of the pamphlets from the stack and putting them inside his jacket, Ian said, gulping. When I saw him, I screeched at him to put them back, and he whirled round at me with a pistol in his hand.
The pistol had discharged, scaring young Ian badly, but the ball had gone wide. Little daunted, the seaman had rushed at the boy, raising the pistol to club him instead.
There was no time to run or think, he said.
He had let go my hand by now, and his fingers twisted together upon his knee.
I reached out for the first thing to hand, and threw it.
The first thing to hand had been the lead dipper, the long-handled copper ladle used to pour molten lead from the melting pot into the casting moulds. The forge had been still alight, though well banked, and while the melting pot held no more than a small puddle, the scalding drops of lead had flown from the dipper into the seaman's face.
God! Oh, he screamed!
A strong shudder ran through young Ian's slender frame, and I came round the end of the sofa to sit next to him and take both his hands. The seaman had reeled backward, clawing at his face, and upset the small forge, knocking live coals everywhere.
That was what started the fire, the boy said. I tried to beat it out, but it caught the edge of the fresh paper, and all of a sudden something went whoosh in my face, and it was as though the whole room was alight.
The barrels of ink, I suppose, Jamie said,
as though to himself.
The powder's dissolved in alcohol.
The sliding piles of flaming paper fell between young Ian and the back door, a wall of flame that billowed black smoke and threatened to collapse upon him. The seaman, blinded and screaming like a banshee, had been on his hands and knees between the boy and the door into the front room of the print shop and safety.
I couldn't bear to touch him, to push him out of the way, he said, shuddering again.
Losing his head completely, he had run up the stairs instead, but then found himself trapped as the flames, racing through the back room and drawing up the stair like a chimney, rapidly filled the upper room with blinding smoke.
Did you no think to climb out of the trapdoor onto the roof? Jamie answered.
Young Ian shook his head miserably.
I didn't ken it was there.
Why was it there? I asked curiously. Jamie gave me the flicker of a smile.
In case of need, as a foolish fox has but one exit to his bolt hole. Though I must say it wasn't a fire I was thinking of when I had it made.
He shook his head, ridding himself of the distraction.
But you think the man didn't escape the fire? He asked.
I didn't see how he could,
young Ian answered, beginning to sniffle again.
And if he's dead, then I killed him. I couldn't tell Da I was a mur.
He was crying again, too hard to get the word out.
You're no a murderer, Ian, Jamie said firmly.
He patted his nephew's shaking shoulder.
Stop now, it's all right. You haven't done wrong, laddie. You haven't, do you hear?
The boy gulped and nodded, but couldn't stop crying or shaking. At last I put my arms around him, turned him, and pulled his head down onto my shoulders, patting his back and making the sort of small, soothing noises one makes to little children. He felt very odd in my arms, nearly as big as a full-grown man, but with fine, light bones, and so little flesh on them that it was like holding a skeleton. He was talking into the depths of my bosom, his voice so disjointed by emotion and muffled by fabric that it was difficult to make out the words.
"Mortal sin,"
he seemed to be saying.
"Damned to hell. Could not tell da. Fraid. Canna go home ever."
Jamie raised his brows at me, but I only shrugged helplessly, smoothing the thick, bushy hair on the back of the boy's head. At last, Jamie leaned forward, took him firmly by the shoulders, and sat him up.
"Look ye, Ian," he said. "No, look. Look at me."
By dint of supreme effort, the boy straightened his drooping neck and fixed brimming, red-rimmed eyes on his uncle's face.
"Now then."
Jamie took hold of his nephew's hands and squeezed them lightly.
"First, it's no a sin to kill a man that's trying to kill you.
The church allows you to kill if you must, in defence of yourself, your family, or your country. So you havena committed mortal sin, and you're no damned.
I'm not.
Young Ian sniffed mightily and mopped at his face with a sleeve. No, you're not. Jamie let the hint of a smile show in his eyes. We'll go together and call on Father Hayes in the morning, and you'll make your confession and be absolved then. But he'll tell you the same as I have.
Oh!
The syllable held profound relief, and young Ian's scrawny shoulders rose perceptibly, as though a burden had rolled off of them. Jamie patted his nephew's knee again.
For the second thing, you needna fear telling your father.
No.
Young Ian had accepted Jamie's word on the state of his soul without hesitation, but sounded profoundly dubious about this secular opinion.
Well, I'll no see he'll no be upset, Jamie added fairly. In fact, I expect it will turn the rest of his hair white on the spot.
But he'll understand. He isn't going to cast you out or disown you, if that's what you're scared of.
You think he'll understand?
Young Ian looked at Jamie with eyes in which hope battled with doubt.
I didn't think he... Has my da ever killed a man?
He asked suddenly. Jamie blinked, taken aback by the question.
Well, he said slowly, I suppose... I mean, he's fought in battle, but I... But to tell you the truth, Ian, I dinna ken.
He looked a little helplessly at his nephew.
It's no the sort of thing men talk about much, aye. Except sometimes soldiers when they're deep in drink.
Young Ian nodded, absorbing this, and sniffed again with a horrid gurgling noise. Jamie, groping hastily in his sleeve for a handkerchief, looked up suddenly, struck by a thought.
That's what you said you must tell me, but not your da?
Because you knew I've killed men before? His nephew nodded, searching Jamie's face with troubled, trusting eyes.
I thought you'd know what to do.
Ah.
Jamie drew a deep breath and exchanged a glance with me.
Well.
His shoulders braced and broadened, and I could see him accept the burden young Ian had laid down. He sighed.
What you do, he said, is first to ask yourself if you had a choice. You didn't, so put your mind at ease. Then you go to confession if you can. If not, say a good act of contrition. That's good enough when it's no a mortal sin. You harbour no fault, mind, he said earnestly, but the contrition is because you greatly regret the necessity that fell on you. It does sometimes, and there's no preventing it. And then say a prayer for the soul of the one you've killed, he went on, that he may find rest and not haunt you. You ken the prayer called Soul Peace? Use that one, if you have leisure to think of it. In a battle, when there is no time, use soul leading. Be this soul on thine arm, O Christ, thou King of the City of Heaven. Amen.
Be this soul on thine arm, O Christ, thou King of the City of Heaven. Amen.
Young Ian repeated under his breath. He nodded slowly.
Aye.
All right. And then?
Jamie reached out and touched his nephew's cheek with great gentleness.
Then you live with it, laddie, he said softly. That's all.
Chapter 28. Virtue's Guardian. You think the man young Ian followed has something to do with Sir Percival's warning? I lifted a cover on the supper tray that had just been delivered and sniffed appreciatively. It seemed a very long time since Mowbray's stew. Jamie nodded, picking up a sort of hot stuffed roll.
I should be surprised if he hadn't, he said dryly. While there's likely more than one man willing to do me harm, I kind of think it likely that gangs of them are roaming about Edinburgh.
He took a bite and chewed industriously, shaking his head.
Nay, that's clear enough.
and nothing to be greatly worried over.
It's not. I took a small bite of my own roll, then a bigger one.
This is delicious. What is it?
Jamie lowered the roll he had been about to take a bite of and squinted at it.
Pigeon minced with truffles, he said,
and stuffed it into his mouth whole.
No,
he said, and paused to swallow.
No, he said again, more clearly. That's likely just a matter of a rival smuggler. There are two gangs that I've had a wee bit of difficulty with now and then.
He waved a hand, scattering crumbs, and reached for another roll.
The way the man behaved, smelling the brandy but seldom tasting it, he may be a dégustateur du vin, someone that can tell from a sniff where a wine was made and from a taste which year it was bottled. A very valuable fellow, he added thoughtfully, and a choice hound to set on my trail.
Wine had come along with the supper. I poured out a glass and passed it under my own nose.
He could track you, you personally, through the brandy? I asked curiously.
More or less. You'll remember my cousin Jared.
Of course I do. You mean he's still alive?
After the slaughter of Culloden and the erosions of its aftermath, it was wonderfully heartening to hear that Jared, a wealthy Scottish émigré with a prosperous wine business in Paris, was still among the quick and not the dead.
I expect they'll have to head him up in a cask and toss him into the Seine to get rid of him,
Jamie said, teeth gleaming white in his soot-stained countenance.
Aye, he's not only alive, but enjoying it.
Where'd you think I'd get the French brandy I bring into Scotland?
The obvious answer was France, but I refrained from saying so. Jared, I suppose, I said instead. Jamie nodded, mouth full of another roll.
Hey!
He leaned forward and snatched the plate out from under the tentative reach of young Ian's skinny fingers.
You're not supposed to be eating rich stuff like that when your wheem's girdled, he said, frowning and chewing.
He swallowed and licked his lips.
I'll call for more bread and milk for you.
But uncle, said young Ian, looking longingly at the savoury rolls, I'm awfully hungry.
Purged by confession, the boy had recovered his spirits considerably, and evidently his appetite as well. Jamie looked at his nephew and sighed.
Aye, well, you'll swear you're no going to vomit on me.
No, uncle, young Ian said meekly.
All right, then.
Jamie shoved the plate in the boy's direction and returned to his explanation.
Jared sends me mostly the second-quality bottling from his own vineyards in the Moselle, keeping the first quality for sale in France, where they can tell the difference.
So the stuff you bring into Scotland is identifiable? He shrugged, reaching for the wine.
Only to a nez, a dégustateur, that is. But the fact is that we Ian here saw the man taste the wine at the Dog and Gun and at the Blue Boar, and those are the two taverns on the High Street that buy brandy from me exclusively. Several others buy from me, but from others as well. In any case, as I say, I'm none so concerned at having someone look for Jimmy Roy at a tavern.
He lifted his wine glass and passed it under his own nose by reflex, made a slight unconscious face, and drank.
No, he said, lowering the glass. What worries me is that the man should have found his way to the print shop. For I've taken considerable pains to make sure that the folk who see Jamie Roy on the docks at Burnt Island are not the same ones who pass the time o' day in the High Street with Mr. Alec Malcolm, the printer.
I knitted my brows, trying to work it out. "But Sir Percival called you Malcolm, and he knows you're a smuggler," I protested. Jamie nodded patiently.
"Half the men in the ports near Edinburgh are smugglers, Sassenach," he said. "Aye, Sir Percival kens fine I'm a smuggler, but he doesn't ken I'm Jamie Roy, let alone James Fraser. He thinks I bring in bolts of undeclared silk and velvet from Holland, because that's what I pay him in."
He smiled wryly.
I trade brandy for them, to the tailor on the corner. Sir Percival's an eye for fine cloth, and his lady even more. But he doesn't ken I've to do with the liquor,
let alone how much. Or he'd be wanting a great deal more than the odd bit of lace and yardage, I'll tell you.
Could one of the tavern owners have told the seamen about you? Surely they've seen you.
He ruffled a hand through his hair, as he did when thinking, making a few short hairs on the crown stand up in a whorl of tiny spikes.
Aye, they've seen me, he said slowly, but only as a customer. Fergus handles the business dealings with the taverns, and Fergus is careful never to go near the print shop. He always meets me here, in private.
He gave me a crooked grin.
No one questions a man's reasons for visiting a brothel, aye?
Could that be it? I asked, struck by a sudden thought. Any man can come here without question. Could the seaman young Ian followed have seen you here? You and Fergus?
Or heard your description from one of the girls? After all, you're not the most inconspicuous man I've ever seen.
He wasn't either.
While there might be any number of red-headed men in Edinburgh, few of them towered to Jamie's height, and fewer still strode the streets with the unconscious arrogance of a disarmed warrior.
"That's a very useful thought, Sassenach," he said, giving me a nod. "It will be easy enough to find out whether a pig-tailed seaman with one eye has been here recently. I'll have Jeanne ask among her lassies."
He stood up and stretched rackingly, his hands nearly touching the wooden rafters.
"And then, Sassenach, perhaps we'll go to bed, aye?"
He lowered his arms and blinked at me with a smile.
"What with one thing and another, it's been the bloody hell of a day, no?"
"It has, rather," I said, smiling back.
Jeanne, summoned for instructions, arrived together with Fergus, who opened the door for the madam with the easy familiarity of a brother or cousin.
Little wonder if he felt at home, I supposed. He had been born in a Paris brothel, and spent the first 10 years of his life there, sleeping in a cupboard beneath the stairs, when not making a living by picking pockets on the street.
"The brandy is gone," he reported to Jamie. "I've sold it to MacAlpine. At a small sacrifice in price, I regret, my lord. I thought a quick sale the best." "Better to have it off the premises," Jamie said, nodding. "What have you done with the body?"
Fergus smiled briefly, his lean face and dark forelock lending him a distinctly piratical air.
"Our intruder also has gone to MacAlpine's tavern, my lord, suitably disguised."
"As what?" I demanded. The pirate's grin turned on me. Fergus had turned out a very handsome man, the disfigurement of his hook notwithstanding.
"As a cask of crème de menthe, milady," he said. "I do not suppose anyone has drunk crème de menthe in Edinburgh any time in the last 100 years, observed Madame Jeanne. "The heathen Scots are not accustomed to the use of civilized liqueur. I've never seen a customer here take anything beyond whisky, beer, or brandy wine." "Exactly, madame," Fergus said, nodding. "We do not want Mr. MacAlpine's tapman broaching the cask, do we?"
"Well, surely somebody's going to look in that cask sooner or later," I said. "Not to be indelicate, but..."
"Exactly, milady,"
Fergus said, with a respectful bow to me.
"Though crème de menthe has a very high content of alcohol. The tavern cellar is but a temporary resting place on our unknown friend's journey to his eternal rest. It goes to the docks tomorrow, and thence to somewhere quite far away. It is only that I did not want him cluttering up Madame Jeanne's premises in the meantime."
Jeanne addressed a remark in French to St. Agnes that I didn't quite catch, but then shrugged and turned to go.
"I will make inquiries of les filles concerning this seaman tomorrow, monsieur, when they are at leisure. For now..." "For now, speaking of leisure," Fergus interrupted, "might Mademoiselle Sophie find herself unemployed this evening?"
The madam favoured him with a look of ironic amusement. "Since she saw you come in, mon petit saucisse, I expect that she has kept herself available."
She glanced at young Ian, slouched against the cushions like a scarecrow, from which all the straw stuffing has been removed.
And will I find a place for the young gentleman to sleep? Oh, aye.
Jamie looked consideringly at his nephew.
I suppose you can lay a pallet in my room.